Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and all this week, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations about history on the program. Later this hour, we're going to hear the story of New Philadelphia, the first American city founded by African Americans. But first, on Abraham Lincoln's birthday earlier this year, we celebrated the life of our 16th president from our nation's capital. While we were there, we visited two historical sites. Later, you're going to hear about a lesser-known site, the Lincoln Cottage. First, though, I got a tour of the Lincoln Memorial. So we're here at the Lincoln Memorial with Heidi Dietz, who is an interpretive park ranger for the National Park Service. So Heidi, you help folks who are coming here understand a little bit more about President Lincoln.
Yes, we get thousands of visitors here every day from all over the world, and they all have a different story that they want to learn about President Lincoln, who he was and what he means today. So I try to help them figure out who Lincoln was and what he can be for each of the visitors.
Is there one thing that you really hope people take away when they come here, regardless of what their background is?
There's so much about Lincoln, so many sides to him and so many elements, and he's so complex, and the time period he lived in was so complex. I guess one of the biggest takeaways that I would love people to take when they leave the memorial is that how much he was for country and how much he was for people. He put himself below country and the unification of country and of people. And so he really put that above all else. You know, he said unity above all, and he really followed that.
Well, I wonder what the most common question is people ask about Abraham Lincoln.
There are a lot of myths about this memorial. Probably the number one myth is that Robert E. Lee is on the back of Lincoln's head here in the chamber. It is not true.
So people come and they look around the
back? Yeah, and like, tour guides would say, yeah, Lee's at the back of Lincoln's head, and I'm standing there thinking.
So do you feel like I have to correct this?
Sometimes I do. I can't help myself sometimes. I'm the bad ranger that way.
No, that's the good ranger.
I always ask people then, it's like, why would Lee be on the back of Lincoln's head? Why Lee? It's maybe because just across the river over in Virginia is Lee's old house, which is now in the center of Arlington National Memorial Cemetery. Or what? I don't know. I always ask them, you tell me, why would Lee be on the back of Lincoln's head? And they can never give me a reason. And so I say, Lee's not on the back of his head. Sorry.
I'm sure that the biggest population of groups that come here are school groups.
Yes.
And school children.
Yes.
And we were talking on this on the way over about our school trips here, or at least for me, it wasn't a school trip, but my parents brought me here when I was, I think, 4 or 5 was my first trip to Washington, D.C. As kids, you have a certain impression of mm-hmm. the memorial. What do you think it's important for adults to know about the Abraham Lincoln Memorial?
Well, for kids, a lot of times the first thing that they notice about the memorial is just how big it is.
That's what I remember. How huge it is.
Bigger he is above, towering over them, and sometimes that can make a very big impression. But for adults, too, even that, they don't realize how big of a memorial this is. They come here and they're like, wow.
How many feet tall?
The statue is 19 feet tall, and so if he stood, he'd be a lot taller. He was 6'3" in real life, a little over 6'3". So the statue is not life size, but so he's still, he was very impressive in size in real life. And so as he remains in memorial shape, he still is impressive. And so adults and children, they take that away, that, wow, he's so big.
I imagine it's a relief that you're open to celebrate President Lincoln's birthday because you were shut during the shutdown. What special things happen at the Lincoln Memorial on President Lincoln's birthday?
On his birthday, we have a celebration. A military band come and perform, and there's a wreath-laying ceremony where dozens of organizations and associations from all over the country, military, patriotic, Lincoln-related, they come and they lay a special wreath in honor of President Lincoln. And we're just here to honor the legacy of President Lincoln.
Why is it important there is this Lincoln Memorial here over the National Mall in our nation's capital?
The Lincoln Memorial, since its dedication in 1922, has become one of the top 5 destinations of all the National Park units in the whole National Park system. So there are over 400 units within the National Park Service, and the Lincoln Memorial on its own is in the top 5 of most visited sites. And I think because it is in the heart of Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, that it brings the millions of people who come here every year. They're coming to Washington, D.C. anyway, school trip, family trip, political trip, whatever reason brings them here to Washington, D.C. And so the Lincoln Memorial has become, they have to come here. This has become the one place they have to visit when they're in Washington, D.C., because it is like the jewel of the National Mall and of Washington, D.C.
That's Heidi Dietz, an interpretive park ranger with the National Park Service. The Lincoln Memorial is, of course, one of our most famous national monuments, but not a lot of people know about another historic Lincoln site. It's his cottage in a quiet northwest part of Washington, where you cannot just walk through the actual spaces where the Lincoln family spent their summers during his presidency, but you'll also be guided through stories that reveal how Lincoln's ideas still affect us today. I spoke with Executive Director and CEO Aaron Carlston Mast and Senior Museum Program Associate Joan Cummins. We stopped by for a visit back in February when we were broadcasting from NPR headquarters in D.C. I started by asking Joan how long it would have taken President Lincoln to get to the cabin from the White House back in the 1860s.
So we took a journey up here from downtown Washington, not too far from the White House, and it took about half an hour. Would that have been how long President Lincoln would have taken, gone by horseback, I assume?
Yeah, mostly solo on horseback. We do think it took about a half hour to, it's 3 miles, more or less, from here to the White House.
And Aaron, what was the idea of this cottage? This was a getaway for President Lincoln and for his family?
Yes, so the whole Lincoln family moved out here, and we know that it's tempting to think that Lincoln was taking himself out here to get away from work and everything else that was stressing him out at the time. But we know that, in fact, by coming here, he was bringing himself closer to the war and its human cost.
And how close?
So, for example, the cottage is only 200 yards away from the First National Cemetery. So that first summer the Lincolns are living here, over 1,000 soldiers are buried in plain view. And it's only a mile and a half south of Fort Stevens, where the Confederates attacked in 1864.
And so was this cottage a safe place for the president during the war?
Well, we know that the first summer that they were living here, they were on their own, essentially, as a family with household staff. And it's not until the end of the summer that Lincoln is assigned a formal presidential guard. He was the first president to have a security detail like that. And it was because of threats against his safety.
Joan, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what this place looked like when President Lincoln was here?
Yeah, so it's a Gothic Revival cottage. It has 34 rooms, so 2 floors, attic, and a basement. It's a big house, and it's built specifically to be cool and comfortable in a DC summer. I'm going to open for you one of the jib doors that leads out onto the south veranda of the cottage. It looks like a normal window, and then there are 2 panels below the window that open and close like this.
Oh, wow, and you really do feel the temperature difference right away. And Aaron, this room that we're in, so the whole idea of this house was meant to be a retreat, but as you all said, the reality was it's not like President Lincoln was really able to escape his work.
That's right, nor did he really seem to want to. Work was really an ever-present part of his life during the Civil War and his presidency. You know, we often think of the president in terms of a lack of accessibility nowadays, you know, constantly being protected. It's very difficult to come and get an audience with the president now. In Lincoln's time, it was fairly simple to try to get an audience with the president. The fact that he was coming out here in the evening did not stop people.
So, Joan, this was actually a room that President Lincoln would have entertained people who would have come to visit.
Yeah, we talk about it as the parlor, and there's one specific visitor who came up to speak to Lincoln whose story we tell in this room. His name was Colonel Scott. He was in the Union Army, and he had lost his wife in a boating accident, and he came up to ask Lincoln for some help in retrieving her body. Scott's very upset. Lincoln replied in this way.
Am I to have no rest? Is there no hour or spot when or where I may escape this constant call? Why do you follow me out here with such business as this? Why do you not go to the War Office, where they have charge of these matters? Don't you know, Colonel Scott, that we are in the midst of war, that suffering and death press upon all of us?
Scott's had an extremely difficult thing happen and is just looking for some help. And Lincoln is dealing with his own personal tragedy as well as the responsibility of carrying the weight of the big picture of all of the bad things that are happening. And I think it's very human to get to the end of a day and not want to talk to whoever the next person is who has a problem for you. And I really appreciate the reminder of Lincoln the person in there inside Lincoln the president. And then there's a little more to the story. Lincoln followed up with Scott the next morning.
My dear Colonel, I was a brute last night. I have no excuse for my conduct. I've had a regretful night. Now, my good man, hurry and get ready. I have seen Secretary Stanton, and he has arranged all. I have my carriage here and will go with you to the wharf. And, Colonel, when you get home, don't tell your children of my conduct last night.
And how do we know all of this happened? Did he write a letter?
So there's a journalist who was accompanying Scott who had sort of clued Scott in that this is where he could find Lincoln. And the journalist recounted it in a book that he was writing.
I'm here with Aaron Carlson Mast, who's the CEO of President Lincoln's Cottage. And we're also here with tour guide Joan Cummins. This is actually a really unusual historical site in D.C. because this actually isn't run by the Parks Department.
That's right. We're the only national monument in the entire country that is not federally funded.
So, Joan, where now are we in President Lincoln's library?
We're in the room that the Lincolns were using as a library while they were here in the cottage. You can see up top there over on the wall and also on the other wall there, the horizontal lines where you can see the bookshelves used to be. You probably know already reading was a huge part of Lincoln's life. It was something how he had educated himself. But he liked to tell stories, especially when trying to explain something to a group of other people. There's one story in particular he told to explain how he was seeing the people around him talk about liberty. Lincoln said Americans all declare for liberty, but when we say that, we don't all mean the same thing. And so he told this story to talk about that. It's about a sheep, a wolf, and a shepherd. So the shepherd stops the wolf from eating the sheep. The sheep looks at the shepherd and says, "Thank you. You're a liberator. You have given me my freedom." And the wolf looks at the shepherd and says, "You are a tyrant. You have taken away my freedom." Lincoln said the sheep and the wolf cannot agree on a definition of the word liberty, and precisely the same difference prevails today among us human creatures. So he's using the story as a way of talking about the people he saw around him and the fact that the people who owned slaves, the wolf, and the people who were enslaved, the sheep, were both using the word liberty to talk about what they wanted. And for me, that really resonates with my experience of living in a democracy and that people can have the same very big scale principles in mind and extremely different ideas about how to get there on the ground. Part of Lincoln's task living here at the cottage, especially in the summer of 1862, as he was developing the Emancipation Proclamation, was to be the shepherd, to make decisions about whose freedom and when and how we were going to move forward as a society that could not agree on this issue.
And so this is where we actually see the germs of all of these ideas that actually became reality, which do lead to the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm. And Lincoln went looking to the existing founding documents for answers on this question, but he found incompatibility there as well. The sheep and the wolf cannot both get what they want. And he went to the Declaration of Independence, has this big, beautiful idea that people have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Constitution upholds the right to property in the form of enslaved people, has a couple other protections for the institution of slavery throughout as well. But Lincoln saw those as incompatible as well, and it was his job to try and figure out how to get those incompatible things to line up with each other again. For a long time, it seemed like that would be an impossible problem to solve. So in a moment, as we go upstairs, we'll be using the same banister and the same steps that Lincoln used. I like to imagine him closing his book here in the library, turning the gas light down, and walking upstairs to bed in his slippers. I don't know if you've ever gone to bed thinking about a problem that felt impossible, but if you have, you know a little bit about what that's like.
So, Joan, this is the room.
Yeah. as best we know, right? This is the room Lincoln was using as his bedroom while he was here, and it's also the room where he came up with the Emancipation Proclamation. A lot of times people ask, like, well, did it really do anything? Lincoln's not on the ground in South Carolina. What can he possibly be doing about it? And the answer is in large part that it's the people who were enslaved who took themselves out from under Confederate control as best they could. And they began to do that pretty much as soon as they heard about it.
How many people are we talking about?
The entire group of people that the proclamation officially applied to is 4 million people. 50,000 is the estimate of people who were able to get free right there on January 1st. The last group of enslaved people to find out about the proclamation didn't find out until June of 1865, after they'd been officially free for about 2.5 years.
So, Aaron, when we think about this place and the fact that we are standing in this room right now where President Lincoln created all of these ideas, I wonder, this is an interesting museum in that you have a space that doesn't necessarily have a lot of historical artifacts, but where you're sort of sharing President Lincoln's ideas. And I wonder, as you think about the Emancipation Proclamation, we have 200 years, two centuries removed from that. And I wonder about what ideas you think are really important that still need to be conveyed.
When we set out to create the cottage, we thought, well, what's the most important thing about Lincoln's time here? And it's the ideas he created in these spaces. This is a real powerful place that Lincoln used to move our country forward. But we also acknowledge that that work is unfinished, and so we are committed to keeping the cottage that home for brave ideas today. And that comes through in the tours every single day with our visitors, and also through a lot of our special programs, including Students Opposing Slavery, which is an international youth abolitionist program that we have. Having this space for Lincoln was nation-changing and changed his life, and we think that the best and highest purpose of the cottage today is to continue that work.
Oh, thank you so much for taking us through this tour. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
That was Joan Cummins and Aaron Carlson Mast from Lincoln's Cottage in D.C. We paid them a visit when we were in Washington earlier this year. Coming up after the break, we're going to continue our history conversations with learning about the first American city founded by African Americans. It was actually right here in Illinois, and it was called New Philadelphia. Stay tuned. We're going to hear the story of that city from the founder's great-great-grandson, who just so happens to be a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois. I'm Nyla Boudou. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to this special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boudou. Illinois is historically known as a state that was founded free from slavery. It's the land of Lincoln, after all. And on this program, we've talked about how the history is often a lot more complicated than that. Illinois may have officially been a free state before the Civil War, but it was still a dangerous place for Black men and women. So in 1836, a former slave named Free Frank McWhorter started a town of his own. It was called New Philadelphia, and it was in western Illinois, just 20 miles from the slave state of Missouri. It eventually became home to both Black and white residents, and it's known as the first town founded by African Americans, certainly in Illinois and perhaps in the entire U.S. You can read all about it in a book called New Philadelphia. It's the work of U of I professors Kate Williams and her husband, Gerald McWhorter, who also happens to be the great-great-grandson of Free Frank McWhorter. Kate is an associate professor in the School of Information Sciences. Gerald is a professor emeritus in the School of Information Sciences. I sat down with both of them in our Urbana studios this January ahead of Martin Luther King Day. I started by asking Gerald to tell us a little bit more about Free Frank and his wife, Lucy. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Good to be here.
Yep.
Gerald, I wonder if we could start with you and your family story, and if you can tell us a little bit more about Free Frank and his wife, Lucy.
Yes. Well, it's a very interesting experience we've had because we grew up with this story. So it was a normal story for us. And it has certainly become a bigger story than just our own personal family story. But my aunt was a student at Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee. And there was much conversation about the fact that Black families were not able to trace their family history. She said, well, we can trace our history. And she went back to Illinois and gathered up documents. And those are the documents that were preserved because there was subsequently a fire and we lost a lot of documents. But because Thelma had brought these documents to Fisk, it was very fortunate for us. But also, the story of Frank and Lucy is really an incredible story, in part because they were both slaves. And Frank was employed by his father, who was a slave owner. And he
And who was white.
He was white, yes. And he was able to hire himself out. When he hired himself out, he was able to save some money. And the first person that he purchased from slavery was his wife, Lucy, who was pregnant. And they wanted the first child, the next child, I should say, not the first child, the next child, to be born free. And that's a you know, a very meaningful story when you think about the whole crisis of discussion around Black men. Well, here's a guy who's a slave who wants to make sure his wife is free and then subsequently frees himself. So that is an important aspect of it. Another aspect is that he was obviously a hardworking person because he begins entrepreneurship even under the conditions of slavery. He had a saltpeter mine. Saltpeter is an ingredient in gunpowder. And so he was able to make a go of that.
How was he able to do that? I was curious about that. Even just the idea that he was able to earn money and to have his own earnings, was that because his father allowed him to do so?
Yes. Hiring out was a practice where a slave would negotiate a percentage of his time to then be able to go out in the marketplace, the job market or whatever, to find a way to make money and share most of that with the owner and be able to keep some for himself. And because he was operating really as a manager of his father's property in Kentucky, in Pulaski County, Kentucky, he was able to have that relationship with the people in the area, that even as a slave, he was representing his father, but under those conditions made arrangements, and so that he had a group of white people who would vouch for him. There were a lot of caves and so forth in that area. So he wasn't the only one mining saltpeter, but was able to do that. And in doing that, really developed an independent spirit. Now, this is a man who couldn't read and write, but was an entrepreneur, would save money and enter into contractual relationships. So we often wonder, what kind of man was that? You know what I mean? Not only did he have this idea about his wife, but to be able to be an entrepreneur under those conditions and to survive. And when he actually, they ended up buying land in Illinois, and when he went, he had people signing documents attesting to his character and to the fact that he was free and a responsible person.
It's a remarkable negotiation to think of how he would have managed to negotiate all of that for himself.
I often wonder if I'm living up to his standard. You know, this is my great-great-grandfather. Anyway, so they get to Illinois, and they are the first settlers other than the indigenous Native Americans who were in the area. Someone once wrote, the first white man in Hadley Township was a colored man, because this was a reference to the Native Americans. And so here are people coming dressed like, you know, settlers and so on. But they were able to find this land, which was really part of the military tract. What happened out of the War of 1812 is that the federal government set aside land that was then distributed to the ex-military men. And that really created a real estate market, because people would then sell their land to invest in other ways. And so Frank was able to take all the property that he had in his mine, salt mine, et cetera, and exchange that for land in Illinois with someone else that he knew had seen the land and had told him it was high ground, that there was near water, and, you know, it looked like something that you could establish a settlement on. And so they were able to make it to Pike County to survive. And, you know, there were lots of people moving around the country in the middle of the 19th century. There were a lot of settlements. Most of them didn't really, weren't sustainable for any number of reasons. Because you can imagine, I mean, if you got sick, you know, what would you do? I mean, you're out in the frontier. And so the town was, you know, he had this idea that not only did he want to free himself and his wife and his first son, who had run from Pulaski County to Canada in the Underground Railroad. And so he was able to purchase him at two or three times the price. And of course, when he came back, it was time to get out of Pulaski County. And so they were able to get to Illinois. But when they got to Illinois, they were leaving relatives back in Kentucky.
And do we know if this was, if from your research, if this was the first town founded by African-Americans in the country?
That seems to be the record. This has been validated by the new Museum of African-American History at the Smithsonian.
So we're learning about the story of New Philadelphia. And Kate, as we're thinking about the McWhorters trying to make a life here in Illinois, obviously still very dangerous, even though Illinois isn't officially a slave state. How does that factor into Frank's decision to buy land, and how does this town in start this settlement, this town?
Well, as Gerald said, he was able to arrange for someone to see the land ahead of time and verify that it was good land to buy. And certainly Illinois was not experiencing the racial shifts that Kentucky was experiencing as slavery became more profound and more market-driven and really deeper in the country. So he was moving north even as he was moving west. But the other thing is that not only were he and Lucy about freeing their family by purchasing the children, which took several decades to do, 16 people purchased altogether, they were about establishing an abolitionist village. So they named the town New Philadelphia. And it immediately, from the time the documents surveying the town and sort of making it official as a small village, really, were created, there were white abolitionists that were on the project. So one of the family's names was Shipman. A Shipman signed, attested that the document, that the survey had been done properly. And the town was founded not only as a place for them to live, but also as lots that they could sell to make more money, to buy people, and to help people get north. So along with the town, Frank also had the franchise. And again, you can imagine navigating and negotiating this in the wild frontier.
I mean, this is the 1830s we're talking about.
Right. He had the franchise to round up all the wild horses in the area. So the saying was, and this was a saying that Gerald grew up knowing, that if you could get to New Philadelphia, those McWhorter boys would get you a horse and a pair of shoes, because one of them was a blacksmith, and so was a European American who lived in the town. And they'd get you to Canada. They'd help get you on your way to Canada. So it was really a multi-family project that was really wonderfully situated in Illinois, because the Mississippi was a corridor of economic and social activity and movement north and south. And people were crossing the river to get to freedom. People were moving up the river and sometimes down the river to get to freedom. So actually, at the same time as we were working on our book, we got wind of another descendant family who was writing a fictional account as a children's story about a little white girl who lives in the area of New Philadelphia, who finds a girl who's running to freedom, and they become friends as she helps nurse her to health and strength so she can keep going north. So that's just an example of how the story lived in that family's memory, to the point where oral history that was done by the archaeologists who later came along in the 2000s to do archaeology of New Philadelphia, also did oral history. And that children's book author's great-great-great-great-aunt told a story about what her grandparents did to help the slaves who were the freedom seekers get free. What they would do is they'd let loose a chicken in the yard, and the dogs would go crazy chasing that chicken. And the patrollers would come along and they'd say, oh, it's just a chicken loose. And they'd move along, and the freedom seekers who'd been hiding in the tall grass would come back into the house and they'd say, okay, time to get in the wagon. And that same family, that same woman, told more stories that just brought their family's role to life. Mm. So,
Gerald, and you grew up with all of these stories.
Yes, they were just part of the family lore. And as I said, my aunt was sort of the family historian, and really worked with Margaret Burroughs in Chicago to found the DuSable Museum. The DuSable Museum was originally founded in Margaret Burroughs' living room, and one of the first exhibits in that opening was about the McWhorter family and New Philadelphia. She also worked with Margaret in founding the Southside Community Arts Center, which is surviving as the only WPA project that's still in existence in the United States. But the other interesting thing about this story is that there are families, as Kate was saying, who still live in the area, who still have memories. There's a man by the name of Harry Wright, who was a county commissioner in Pike County. Not only did he remember a part of a creek where there was a cave, where the oral history was that this is where people hid. But as a I mean, I'm now 76 years old, and when I was about six, there's a picture of me in New Philadelphia in a field, and behind me there's a horse, and Harry Wright knew the name of that horse. I mean, that's how memory is so current, and history lives among people. One of the things that we've learned is that in all the counties, there's a local county historical society, and there are local museums, and there are people who are experts in local history. There was a woman whose name was Janita. What was her last name?
Metcalf.
Metcalf. And she, when we met her, she pulled out a book, 1836, of the Berry Baptist Church, showing where Frank McWhorter had been sent to a religious meeting, he and another person representing the church. Now, of course, why did they send Frank? Was there a second agenda that had to do with abolition? These are all questions. See, history has to be not only collecting the dots of documents, it has to do with the historical imagination, what kind of narrative makes sense in connecting these documents. And the more documents you find, the more the narrative can be expanded and changed. So here she is pulling out a church record of Frank in 1836. It turns out that this woman, Clarissa Shipman, was a letter writer, and she wrote tons of letters. They lived on a farm next to Frank McWhorter. Her children went to seminary, an abolitionist seminary in Quincy, Illinois, and then went to Hawaii as missionaries. She wrote them letters that were detailed about the daily life of people in New Philadelphia. Kate found out about all of this. We called the woman in Hawaii, got on a plane and went to Hawaii, and with our phones, we copied, took pictures of 1,500 pages of correspondence from Clarissa Shipman to her children, and we found out all kind of details about McWhorter life and about life in New Philadelphia.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Gerald McWhorter and Kate Williams McWhorter about their book, New Philadelphia. I want to ask you a little bit more about your background in information sciences and how that helped put this book together, and also find out a little bit more about the town and what happened to it. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and if you're just tuning in, we're revisiting our conversation with Kate Williams McWhorter and Gerald McWhorter. They're co-authors of a book called New Philadelphia, the first town in Illinois founded by African Americans. It was started in 1836 by a former slave named Free Frank McWhorter, who also happens to be Gerald's great-great-grandfather. I spoke with both of them back in January ahead of Martin Luther King Day. I asked Kate to tell us a little bit more about who lived in New Philadelphia.
Well, let's see. We don't know that every single resident of the town was an abolitionist, but we also, from the census, we don't catch those people who were coming through New Philadelphia because they were more transitory. And so we feel that New Philadelphia probably impacted a lot more than those 160, partly because it was a magnet in a very rural society, and partly because it was a place people were going through to go north. The town included a general store, as we've mentioned, the blacksmith, teachers.
Post office and school.
Cobbler, right. And the school in particular was a really important cultural and social center for the town. The school was important for us as well because out of hearing that the book was underway, people brought us pictures of school groups. And those pictures, very often, if you turn them over, they were those rare pictures that actually have names on them. And that helped us connect.
And these are from the 1800s?
And the 19th century.
Okay.
From the 1800s, 1900s, and into the 20th century. So we could see the families that stayed there over time. And some of them, like we've said, have talked to the historians in the oral history.
So, Gerald, I wonder how New Philadelphia was able to exist with all of these other towns, what their relationship was like with other towns around them, if they had problems. I would imagine, when it's originally started in the 1830s, I don't know if during the Civil War, if this became more of an issue in terms of safety for people.
Well, there are several things. First, the McWhorters were interesting people. There were four generations that grew up in New Philadelphia. And one of the interesting things that was consistent across those generations was technology. For example, they raised pedigreed livestock. And we have some of the documents. Like, there's this famous pig whose name was Lady Pike, named after the county. So they were known for raising prize livestock and shipping them even back east. So that was one aspect of it.
So it sounds like there was a lot of different business going on, whether it was the horses or this livestock. Certainly it sounds
And a post office. That's another very important point, because that means that was really a place of record. And so when we talk about the number of people that lived in the town, it doesn't reflect the fact that it was a center. It was a market town. So farmers from around came to New Philadelphia to do business and to deal with the post office. Another aspect is technology and innovation. So that Solomon, the first male child that Frank went back, because they made at least two trips back to Kentucky.
Well into the 1850s to get children, to free their own children.
And so Solomon was freed when he was 20. And as it turns out, Solomon gets back to Pike County and invents a pan process for processing sorghum. This is very important because the abolitionists did not want to use the sugar cane from the South that was based on slavery. They call that blood-stained sugar. And so they wanted to use this sugar that came through China to France to the U.S., sorghum. And so he was the first African-American to get a patent for this process in Illinois and the eighth in the United States. So that was another aspect. And then, as it turned out, another McWhorter who grows up in New Philadelphia ends up inventing what he called the autoplane and got a patent. And people from the Pentagon, from Washington, actually came to see it. And it becomes then one of the predecessors to the modern helicopter. This is a very interesting group of people. Now, in his case, the family history is he was a nerdy little kid who sat outside the barn and really didn't do a lot of farm work.
He wasn't doing farm work because he was trying
to
invent things.
No, but he was drawing things and scribbling, and it turns out he invented something. But the other thing about the town is that, and this is something we don't know. See, a lot of times people think that it was mainly white people who were the people who ran the Underground Railroad. But one of the things we found out by reliving this story and getting more into it is if you were we call them freedom seekers, not runaways, but freedom seeker, and you were coming up on a settlement, where would you go?
How would you know?
Well, the first thing you would do is look for some other black people, and that's where you would go. Now, once you got to some black people, they might tell you who was white and cool enough for you to go there to get some help. So as it turns out, we actually believe that the Underground Railroad went through every black settlement.
It makes sense.
Of course. That you could get to. And we have stories about that.
What happened to the town of New Philadelphia? So the settlement officially, its status as a town, was that about 1885 that the town lost its status?
The town was formally, legally ended in 1885. But people still live there. And that's why we call it a settlement. And the way in which all these small towns were impacted had to do with the economic development. And there were two main things that happened. First, there was a railroad that came through. And it was essentially a railroad that was influenced by people from Missouri that we figure, this is something that came out of research that Chris Fennell, who's on the faculty here at the University of Illinois, had a pro-slavery kind of attitude. And so when you look at the actual path of the railroad, it comes along, and then there's like a little jump where it would have gone through New Philadelphia and goes on. So had the railroad gone through New Philadelphia, it would have then become a much more economically viable place because other people would have come to that junction to unload and load produce, et cetera. So that impacted the town. Of course, we also think that maybe some of the people thought that was a good thing. Don't bring that mess through here. So, you know, that's another aspect of it. But the second thing that happened is that there just weren't any jobs. when somebody would die and they had many children, then the children would inherit the land. Well, that then continued to divide the land into smaller pieces and made it less likely that it would be able to sustain. And then, of course, corporate agriculture was growing, and therefore people began to migrate away. And that's what happened to the McWhorters. The McWhorters who were there migrated away. My father, for example, who grew up in New Philadelphia and went to school in New Philadelphia and then went to Barry High School. The first thing he did is a circus came through and he ran away with the circus. Anyway, he came back and then eventually went to Chicago with his brother and his sisters. They got jobs. And my father was a steel worker and my uncle became a bus driver and my aunt became a school teacher. It was a economic issue that really changed the whole area.
But one thing that's very interesting is while several of the children and then grandchildren did move away as part of this migration to the cities that the whole country was undergoing, a number of them came back at their last years of their life and were buried in New Philadelphia. So the story of the, as we put it, seven ways to freedom, held on to them for their whole long lives. Some of them lived into their 90s, and they brought themselves back to be buried there.
I wanted to ask you guys two more questions. First, just the site is a National Historic Landmark now, but you and other folks who are part of the New Philadelphia Society would like it to become a national park?
Yes. What has happened is the New Philadelphia Association, which came out of this desire to remember the town, has helped it get to a study that was voted on by Congress and signed by Obama when he was president, and that is now under study. One of the crises, of course, is that the National Park Service got many different projects. They're just struggling for funds, and so we don't know exactly how it's going to go, but all indications are very positive. Because after all, it has great historic significance. And both the African-American Museum and the American History Museum of the Smithsonian.
Both of those Smithsonian museums.
Both of those Smithsonian museums have exhibits right now on New Philadelphia. My aunt, the one I've been referring, Thelma, has several paintings about New Philadelphia, and they sent a photographer to our house here, and they're now blown up big as part of the permanent exhibit at the American History Museum of the Smithsonian.
But the other thing is that New Philadelphia is really in the record. There have been a really important descendant to speak about is Juliet Walker, who wrote the book Free Frank, very much based on the family documents. And that book was her dissertation here at Illinois.
No, at the University of Chicago.
Sorry, University of Chicago. But it was published as a book. And that and the archaeology really created a lot of academic and research writing about New Philadelphia. And our book is really an effort to grab all that up and present it to the public along with the oral history and family story to make sure that the story doesn't only exist for specialists.
Gerald, you talked about the stages of the book, and the last stage of the book is memory. And I wanted to ask you about that. We're airing this conversation on a day that we have as a national holiday to commemorate Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And obviously, these are two very different time periods that we're talking about here. Dr. King's life in the 60s and the civil rights movement. But I wonder how you think the story of New Philadelphia should shape the way we remember race in this country.
We have a saying, if New Philadelphia was possible, then maybe this country is possible. And what that means is that we have to ask the question, what is the grand narrative of this country? If this is a country of immigrants, even with the blood-soaked history of a settler colony, it nevertheless is a narrative of freedom. The people who came here were seeking freedom. And that's what New Philadelphia was about. It was people who were seeking freedom. And so when we talk about Martin Luther King and his family and the movements of the 60s And the legacy that we live today is all about freedom. And so when we talk about New Philadelphia, we don't talk about it really as a story of a family, although obviously
it's your family story.
The fact that the freedom seekers came through New Philadelphia means that the meaning of New Philadelphia touched so many people who are out there who don't know. And so we think of it as our story, just as we think of every Black community as a station on the Underground Railroad. And we think everyone must pursue the history of their family and the town they live in. All too often, we go to a small town and we talk to the young people and we say, what's going on around here? And the answer is nothing. Well, what do you want to do? I want to get out of here. Well, the fact of the matter is if they turned and got the stories and the history of that local community, they would have a completely different understanding of American history and of themselves. And that's the point. It's not about the big city. It's not about the glory of what you see on television. It's about the meaning of people's lives as they've struggled to make meaning of their lives. And everybody's got an uncle that drank too much. Everybody's got a cousin that nobody likes their jokes. But if you tell that story in a certain way, it's better than anything you can find on television.
And we're seeing that unfold because one of our upcoming gigs to talk about New Philadelphia is with the Pittsfield High School History Club. Emily and the others in that club and their history teacher have galvanized around local history, including New Philadelphia. And the local history activists who are getting up in years are really, really grateful and happy to see this younger generation really dig into their local community with this attitude of we don't have to go somewhere else to find out where some really important stuff happened.
The book is called New Philadelphia, and the authors are Kate Williams McWhorter and Gerald McWhorter. Thank you for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. If you want to search there for the 21st, you can like us, and it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, if you want to leave us a voicemail as well, send us an email, or remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows archived there. You can find us also most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Search for The 21ST. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.